Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thank you for listening. You can download more Intelligence Squared podcasts free on iTunes and SoundCloud. If you'd like to find out more about our events, sign up to our newsletter at intelligencesquared.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
I can think of hardly a debate question which is more important, not just to people in schools and universities, but for the country than this debate tonight, because it goes to the very heart, not just of what happens in schools, but the kind of young people whose schools are turning out. And we're very lucky to have two formidably powerful speakers on either side, and they, with ferocious intellects and piercing arguments, are going to identify the votes. And I am going to get straight on, because I'm conscious of the time, and invite the first speaker. I'm going to remind us what the motion is. It is this. Let's end the tyranny of the test. Relentless school testing demeans education. That is our motion tonight. And to speak for the motion, we have Tristram Hunt, Shadow Education Secretary, who has former. I'm sure that these brilliant notes will be as up to date. Former Shadow Education Secretary, who has called for a radical overhaul, not of the Labour Party, of course, but of the testing regime in UK's secondary schools. Tristram, over to you.
Anthony, thank you. Friends, comrades. I'm still getting used to it. What is education for? Why do we spend £50 billion a year of public money on our schools and colleges? And as parents suffer from that weekly Sunday night question, but why do I have to go to school? Not a fear at Walthamstow Academy. The word education, we know, is derived from ducere, to lead, educare, to mould or shape, educare, to bring out. But education is much more than the individual acquisition of knowledge and skills. Our schools instill a sense of history and shared fate, encourage cultural literacy and reflection, the maintenance of community, nation, and place. As John Dewey, the American educationalist, put it, education in its broadest sense is the means of the social continuity of life. And whether it be William Lovett's Chartist Schools, R.H. Tawney and the Workers' Educational Association, Anthony Crossland and the Comprehensive Movement, or Andrew Adonis' sponsored academy programme, a belief in the emancipatory power of schooling, its ability to lift people out of poverty and deliver social justice, has always been core to the Labour movement. And this evening, Tony Little and I have come together to argue a simple case. We believe that the means have become a barrier to the end. The tyranny of the test has overtaken the true purpose of education, and all our children are poorer for it. In the spirit of the new politics, let me begin with some points of agreement. We all believe that effective assessment of children studying at school is vital. We think that strong accountability is essential. We think that a rigorous academic education or rigorous vocational training is a birthright of British citizens. We believe that knowledge is power, and we are not here this evening to make excuses for low expectations. But when the sole purpose of education has become the exam, when the test is the be-all and end-all of schooling, then something important has ended in our education system. When I was Labour's education spokesman, I lost count of the number of head teachers who told me that something simply had to give. For example, there was the ironic note I received from a very brilliant head teacher in Birmingham. And he wrote to me that a head teacher's most common advice in the last 3 years has been, make sure the kids are doing IGCSE English, narrow your curriculum at Key Stage 4 to study the easiest, most data-valuable courses, focus on Progress 8 and the three buckets, put your intervention resources in Year 11 and on those students on the cusp of passing, and show compassionate realism with those who have no chance of passing. His argument was that somehow the cumulative effect of all this had begun to choke something precious. It's as if, he said, we have buried the joy, wonder, and beauty of schooling beneath an avalanche of bureaucracy. As John Cridland, the Director General of the Confederation for British Industry, puts it, at the moment we have a system almost exclusively focused on exam results and a floor standard which allows up to 40% of a school's pupils to fail. But what is worse is that this system of testing and retesting is not even preparing our young people properly for the jobs, society, and challenges of the coming century. Even the man behind the international PISA league tables comparing the education of different nations thinks that the current system is past its sell-by date. Andreas Schleicher has rightly warned that the world economy no longer pays you just for what you know. The world economy pays you for what you can do with what you know. We see a rapid decline in the demand for routine cognitive skills in our world, and the kind of things that are easy to test and easy to teach are also the things that are easy to digitise, automate, and outsource. In short, the current testing regime is in danger of training up a generation for a labour market set to vanish before their very eyes. So we need schools that prepare students for jobs that have not yet been created, technologies that have not yet been invented, and problems that we don't yet know will arise. We need an education system built on academic and technical rigour that goes beyond existing boundaries, that merges the technical, the creative, the academic. It's certainly what the late Steve Jobs, the genius behind Apple computers, wanted from the education system. He wrote, "It is in Apple's DNA that technology alone is not enough. It's technology married with liberal arts, married with the humanities that yields the results that makes our hearts sing." Because what we need alongside the testing is creativity and character. It is fragile schools in disadvantaged areas with tough intakes, having trouble attracting high-quality teachers who too often double down on the testing and assessment to keep their heads above water. It is the thriving schools who have the confidence to keep the sport, art, computer science, chess clubs, debate mates that make the difference to children's education. This co-curricular activity provides the so-called soft skills of collaboration, partnership, empathy, enterprise, managing with failure, which we know are so important for students' success at college or in work. So our message tonight is a social justice one. Far from the current orthodoxy, which suggesting that testing liberates the potential of all working class students. It is now starting to deprive too many disadvantaged young people of exactly the education and skills that they need. So as part of this debate, we wish to put forward three propositions. First of all, rather than the government's plan to introduce yet another layer of English and maths testing, let's focus on what matters, the quality of teaching in the classroom. No education system can exceed the quality of its teachers. And where I would actually be in favour of more uniformity is with greater consistency in the professional development and training of teachers. Secondly, let's work to abolish GCSEs over the coming decade. When we had a school leaving age of 16, when the old divisions between academic and vocational were so clear-cut, when relatively few students proceeded onto A-level, then the O-levels and GCSEs had their point. But now they are becoming an outmoded anachronism. And in their place, let's introduce a proper 14 to 19 upper secondary baccalaureate system, which allows for greater movement between academic and vocational courses, which combines core learning with specialist subjects and allows students to undertake extended projects as well as develop a richer understanding of citizenship and wider personal skills. Because the truth of the matter is that despite all the hard work of teachers, governors, head teachers, pupils and parents, our schools are failing to provide the breadth and quality of education our nation will need. Rigour matters, but the tyranny of the testing hall is not providing the knowledge, skills, social mobility or fulfilment, dare I say also the happiness our education system deserves. And as a result, we are failing to educate, to lead, mould and bring out the best in our young people. So I urge you, like a room full of Corbynistas high on granita, to rise up and support this motion. Thank you.
So Daisy Christodoulou is now going to come up and she will speak to this bunch of Corbynistas. Daisy, who will now take to the podium, if I can just say a few words about her, head of research at the well-known charity ARC and author of Seven Myths About Education. She argues that children are being let down by discovery learning, which places the emphasis on students finding out for themselves. And instead, Daisy advocates traditional fact-based lessons. Daisy Christodoulou.
Thank you, Anthony. Good evening, everyone. Well, again, in the spirit of compromise, there are a number of things that the first speaker said that I do agree with, and I'd like to say what they are and express our agreement on those. So I think we agree also on the importance of effective assessment. We agree, too, on the importance of strong accountability. We agree, too, also that endless resits of exams are often very damaging. We agree that sometimes government targets have not been helpful in that process, that some of these government targets have been blunt measures which have encouraged gaming. As a teacher, as an English teacher myself, I know what it's like being on that treadmill of trying to get the coursework in and the exams, and I would agree that there are aspects of that which are damaging. So there are plenty of things we would certainly agree with there. And we certainly agree that there have been abuses and misuses of tests. But I think where we disagree is that whilst we accept there have been abuses of tests, this in no way changes our fundamental opinion that tests are some of the most powerful and beneficial tools we have available to us in modern education. And in fact, it's because they're so powerful, actually, that they're sometimes capable of being misused. And in fact, we can take antibiotics as an analogy. Antibiotics are sometimes misused with extremely dangerous consequences, but I think most people would accept that they're still one of the most brilliant and beneficial inventions of the 20th century. And so too with tests. As Sir Philip Sidney said, shall the abuse of a thing make the right use odious? On this side of the house, we think not. And we also think that one of the reasons why tests get misused too often is that too often they're subject not to constructive criticism, but to knee-jerk anti-test rhetoric of the type which unfortunately is embodied in tonight's title, of rhetoric which sees tests as being inimical somehow to the spirit of education. Such attitudes make tests seem like as though they are the enemy, and they stop us from realising their full potential, which, as I'm about to show, often involves doing more tests. So, on to then the main part of my speech. Why is it that we on this side of the House think that, far from being tyrannised by tests, we don't actually give them enough power, that we don't test relentlessly enough? We have four reasons. Toby's going to go on to explain later how tests help prepare students for everyday life, and he'll also explain how they do improve education by promoting evidence-based practice and exposing pseudoscience, of which, unfortunately, there's quite a lot in education. I will explain how tests provide the most accurate information about how a pupil has done at the end of their time in school, and also how they provide the most accurate information about how pupils are doing during their time at school, and thus help to actually improve education. So, first of all, then, tests are accurate, they're reliable, they're fair, they are free from bias. Now, of course, it's easy to cherry-pick anecdotes about pupils who were great at tests but went on to be terrible at life and vice versa. But if we look at the actual evidence, the evidence shows that tests are really good predictors of things that really matter in life. So far from it being that things that are easy to test don't matter at all, as Tristram asserted, in actual fact, the evidence shows us that tests are very good predictors of all those kind of complex problem-solving skills that we absolutely need in the 21st century. So let me give you an example. There was a fascinating study recently by two American researchers which tracked those pupils who scored the very highest grade in the American SATs, the standardised tests, at the age of 13. And they tracked those pupils and found out what they were doing at age of 38. And those pupils, as you might expect, had achieved some quite traditional successes in business and academia and law and what have you. But they'd also achieved success for more creative endeavours. So lots of them had won recognition for their paintings and sculptures, for their novels, their plays, their poems, for the theatrical productions that they put on. So tests really do predict complex, worthwhile and meaningful things. And in the end, that's why we actually have a society, not just our society, but societies around the world, set up to rely on tests and to use that information. Universities and employers, for example. And if you get rid of tests, what you have to accept is that you won't just, universities and employers won't then just say, well, we'll gather no information. They'll instead gather information from other means. So if you want to reduce the burden, the alleged burden of testing in the current system, it's incumbent upon you to suggest alternative ways that we might collect this information. And most of these alternative methods, Tristram mentioned one, the extended project, for example. You can think of others, coursework, controlled assessment, teacher assessment, interviews, for example. All of these alternative methods have huge flaws, besides which the very small flaws in tests actually pale into insignificance. And let me point out what I think is the most important of these flaws, and it's an overlooked flaw. It's that these alternative methods of assessment are biased. They are systematically biased against some of the most disadvantaged pupils in our society, and they also systematically reinforce common stereotypes. So let me give you an example. Just one. I could take lots of examples here. It's a very well-attested finding. But let me take just one example of what I'm talking about, a very recent one from the English context, which is very relevant to what we're talking about today. So currently, pupils at the age of 7 in England are not tested. They are teacher-assessed. Their teachers give them a mark based on their own judgment. And recently, a very interesting study was done by academics at the Institute of Education. They took pupils' teacher assessments at the age of 7, and they gave those same pupils a standardised test, and they compared the two. And what they found was very, very interesting. They found that low-income pupils did worse on the teacher assessment than they did on the standardised test. After controlling for everything else, low-income pupils did worse on the teacher assessment than on the standardised test. And I repeat that because I think it's a little-known finding. A lot of people seem to think that teacher assessment somehow benefits disadvantaged pupils. Actually, it doesn't. And there were other interesting findings in that same study as well. The teacher assessments often tended to reinforce common stereotypes. So, for example, boys were overmarked in mathematics. Girls were overmarked in reading. Asian boys were overmarked in mathematics on the teacher assessment. Black Caribbean girls were undermarked. So here is a very clear example of a point in the current education system where everybody would be better served by increasing testing, not reducing it. We'd be better off with tests at 7 than teacher assessment. So why does this happen? Why does this bias exist? Now, I want to be completely clear about this. It's not because teachers are nasty people trying to do down the working class. Most of this bias is unconscious. And that's actually what makes it so hard to tackle. And whilst I've talked about teacher assessment, I wouldn't want you to get the impression that this bias is somehow particular to teachers. That actually what we find is that to the extent that teachers are biased, it's not because they're teachers, it's because they're human. And the author of the research that I've just outlined was at pains to stress this. She said that humans use stereotypes as the cognitive shortcut. We're all prone to this. So what that means is that other methods of assessment that rely on this kind of human judgment, such as interviews, for example, are also prone to exactly the same biases and stereotypes outlined above. And at this point, I want to offer a quick word of warning about character education. Now, we on this side of the house are absolutely in favour of character education, but I am slightly wary at the moment of some of the noise I'm hearing about perhaps grading character or assessing character and using character education as a means of assessing pupils. And whilst I'm absolutely in favour of teaching character, the measurement of character is in its infancy. And one of the main researchers in this field, Angela Duckworth, has said that such measurements are not ready for any serious kind of high-stakes use. If we did end up grading pupils on character and using such grades for anything significant, then I will guarantee you that it will become effectively another middle-class ramp, a way for the underachieving children of middle-class professionals to game the system in their favour. If we get rid of tests, we will inevitably end up depending more on assessment which disadvantages the already disadvantaged and reinforces prevailing stereotypes. Now, in the not-too-recent past, these patterns were much better understood than they are today. In the 19th century, the civil service reformers Charles Northcote and Stafford Trevelyan fought a long battle to make entry to the civil service based on merit rather than family connections. In the early 20th century, pioneering labour educationists such as R.H. Tawney, who Tristram mentioned, and Beatrice and Sidney Webb fought for an education system based around exams. R.H. Tawney didn't just believe, as Tristram rightly said, in the emancipatory power of education. He believed in the emancipatory power of exams because he thought that only exams could ensure that underprivileged children were treated fairly. Only exams could counter entrenched privilege. Very little has changed since then. If anything, we have more research to back up Tawney's view. Exams are still the fairest means of assessment, and if you care about meritocracy, social mobility and fairness, then you must be in favour of them. So, very well, you might say. Suppose we accept exams provide us with this vital and necessary information. Doesn't that at best make them a necessary evil? You might say, for example, as many people do, that weighing the pig isn't the same as feeding it. Well, if you did say that, you'd be wrong. There's actually a huge body of evidence about how taking tests actually helps learning. When we struggle to recall information from long-term memory, as we do in an exam, it actually helps to solidify that memory in our minds. So testings have a learning benefit. They have a learning effect. They also help us to overcome the natural bias we have when we sometimes overestimate what we've learned. We can use familiarity with understanding. So there's an obvious classroom implication here that not just do we need more tests at the end of education, we need more tests in the classroom to check how we're doing. That having more tests in the classroom will help students and it will help teachers as well. So to sum up, we need tests and we need more of them. We need more of them at those crucial moments when we're collecting information about how students have done. And we need them at those crucial moments in the classroom when students are trying hard to master new knowledge. We need relentless testing for more fairness and we need relentless testing for better education. Thank you.
Thank you, Daisy Christodoulou. And now the second speaker for the motion is that other well-known fan of the current leader of the Labour Party, Tony Little, who has been headmaster of Eton College, has been a head for 26 years at the very apex of his profession for over a generation, the most respected indeed head of the independent sector in a generation. Tony Little is going to be speaking for the motion. Tony Little.
Thank you, Chairman. It occurs to me that this side of the House is prefixed by the word former on both cases. We are alive, and we are vibrant and dynamic. Ladies and gentlemen, picture, if you will, the scene. I am observing a lesson in a good local school. I'm a little distracted by the large posters on the wall listing syllabus requirements, but the lesson's ticking along pretty well. The teacher clearly has a good rapport with her pupils. We're reading a poem, and we reach the line, "And the heart sings for freedom." at which point a pupil puts up her hand and asks for clarification about the assessment objectives for the poem. It was a class of 13-year-olds. I'd like you just to hold that image and hold those words in mind. I shall come back to the singing heart a little later. In close on 40 years of teaching, I have come clearly to see that one of the most baleful influences on our schoolchildren is when teachers and schools believe their own myth. They think they're really pretty good, or rather special, without robust independent evidence to verify it. As the head of a turnaround school in Slough memorably told me as he was battling to get things better, assumption is the mother of all cock-ups. Schools need rigor and accountability. I am a fan of inspection, of assessments of various kinds, of the publication of data. These things matter. Indeed, I saw at first hand the beneficial effect of league tables. Former pupils of the school of which I was then head wrote to me in great anger, demanding to know why their school in this first league table wasn't nationally in the top three, as it had been in their day. Chance would be a fine thing. 250th was the highest the school had ever achieved. Puffed-up parochialism cannot withstand the glare of scrutiny, and that is a good thing. Recently, I have been head of a school which year on year produces pretty good exam results, and I have seen it as a personal responsibility of mine to ensure that my students are as well prepared as they can be. So why am I standing with Tristram Hunt on this side of the debate? Let's fast forward 20 years. There are wonderful opportunities with new technologies, new ways to think about thinking, new ways to learn, new ways to access and disseminate knowledge. In 20 years' time, teenagers, schoolchildren generally, may see teachers, as we understand them, as irrelevant. There are certainly those who say and believe that schools as we know them will be redundant. Well, maybe. I suspect not. What these new developments will do is cause us to focus more clearly on what schools are really for. And Tristram Hunt was quite right to draw our attention to those crucial underlying principles. For me, a good school is a means outside the home to help young people learn how to navigate adult life effectively, with purpose and with compassion. Now, try as I might, I can't insert the phrase "sitting an exam at a desk" into that sentence. Now, I know, of course, most of us would agree that exams should never be seen as the be-all and end-all, nor even a determining agent. They're just one part of a much broader experience that young people need through their school years. But the trouble is, we've allowed the whole exam measurement business to go too far. It's run away with itself. We examine more than most other countries in the world with relatively little to show for it. We inhabit a great age of measurement, and we run the risk of being slaves to statistics. Now, that's a pretty tough claim. What do I mean by that? Well, first, we have unwittingly created a shrinking curriculum. Now, that seems rather an odd thing to say. Ask any teacher in the room, and they would say that barely a year goes by without some new and often unwanted intrusion into the curriculum, whether it's a new topic to be taught, citizenship, or the tweaking of an exam syllabus. But the truth is, we are narrowing the range of opportunities for our young people. Witness the schools under pressure of league tables, the whole measurement culture, who shoehorn students onto courses the children may not wish to do, or for which they're not particularly suited, or for which they won't get benefit. But the school perceives there is mileage in measurement terms. Or schools that have learnt how to tweak the system, finding an IT course, for example, and putting all the children through it because it can garner 4 GCSE grades. Or witness the effect that excluding creative arts from the EBAC has had in a number of schools. Schools, naturally enough, under pressure, will place their resources at the sharp end, where things are seen to matter. In some schools I have witnessed, there's evidence that creative arts are already withering. They've been shoved to the margins. Now, where will all this lead us? There's a kind of inevitable reductio ad absurdum about this. And, you know, I think I've seen it. I have been there. I'm speaking of a place which is the nirvana for the exam enthusiasts, that ultimate place of success. Written lights, I speak of Shanghai, that place which is lauded and to which we must send people, our own teachers, to learn how to teach better. Now, I visited a lot of schools in China, and there are some remarkable people doing remarkable things. But I was particularly struck 2 or 3 years ago talking to the head of one of the 2 or 3 top-performing schools in Shanghai. So we're talking serious Premier League stuff here. And he was expressing real concern that his students, trapped by the Gaokao, as he described it, that's the equivalent of A-level, trapped by this exam system, which was so rigid, he feared his students weren't gaining the skills and the competence and the ability to cope effectively in a rapidly changing and developing interconnected world. And this is what he said through a translator, and it's a phrase that really hit me. Just remember who we're talking about here. Leading head of top school in top performing area in the world. He told me, I know we're on a juggernaut heading for the edge of a cliff, but we don't know how to change direction. Another thing we have managed to do is to atomize knowledge. One definition of a great education that's always stuck in my mind is that students should be able to connect and understand apparently disparate phenomena. You think about it, it's the interconnectedness of the world. As Ian Forster says in Howard's End, only connect. Yet we persist in running an exam system which breaks up knowledge into little bits, bite-sized chunks, and which removes the opportunity for students to learn how to connect. And worse still, can penalise students for cross-fertilising ideas. A few years ago, we had a boy called Tom at my school, outstanding historian, a lot of flair, a lot of creative ability, the kind of student whose work it was a delight to read. We were somewhat surprised to discover on his A-level that he had one module that was graded U, unclassified, off the scale. We had his paper back. We thought it was rather well written. We showed it to a couple of university dons who agreed. Once we checked it against the rubric of the exam scheme, we had to agree the board was right. Why? Because this student had argued the question from back to front to make a point, and he'd brought in other references and other reading to supplement his argument. And on both counts, he fell outside the rigid mould of this exam system. And there was a consequence. He dropped a grade and lost his place at university. Both within and across subjects, we have limited the ability to make connections in an exam system, which in my time as a head has become more segmented and more focused on the parts at the expense of the whole. And there are other creative ways of going about it. Daisy was rather dismissive of other types of assessment. I am not going to be dismissive of the traditional test. It has its place. I think there's a tremendous discipline in having to garner your thoughts and focus on a particular occasion. But there are extended essays in IB, universally applauded by universities because it enables children to develop ideas, or the Crest Awards, sponsored by the British Scientific Association, where students can come together in a group, solve a problem they've identified, and be assessed as a group, which mirrors the kind of activity they have in the workplace. It doesn't have to be the way it is now. But the thing that gives me the greatest concern is the erosion of culture, and the fact that teachers and students, under pressure of this kind of relentless, monolithic beast, are thinking about the process of learning in a rather different way. Back to the singing heart. There was a lesson where the poetry was ripped out of poetry in a prosaic way. And this concern about erosion was most brutally captured for me in the following scene. Head of a Catholic comprehensive, doing a good job turning it around, nervously awaits his Ofsted inspection. Inspector comes in and says, "Don't give me that ethos stuff. I just want your statistics." I hope you're rather shocked by that. I certainly was. Assessment matters. We know that. Assessment matters. But the way things stand, our monolithic exam structure
is indeed a juggernaut heading for the edge of the cliff. We need exams, sure, but we also need to let the heart sing without prompting from attainment objectives. I urge you to support the motion.
And Tony Little was also the author of An Intelligent Person's Guide to Education. Toby Young is author of How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, How to Set Up a Free School, and What Every Parent Needs to Know. Toby is also chief executive of the West London Free School Academy Trust, as well as editor of Spectator Life. And everyone has been excellent with timekeeping, and I know that Toby is going to keep up that.
Thank you, Anthony. Let me get this right. We're in a juggernaut heading over a cliff, and we don't know how to change direction. Sounds to me like the guy should have taken a driving test before getting behind the wheel. So Tristram and Tony have made a case for overhauling our present testing regime, but would the system they'd like to put in its place really involve less testing? In April of last year, Tristram gave a speech to the NASUWT in Birmingham, in which he launched a passionate attack on the government's decision to decouple AS levels from A levels, which would make it possible for children to do A levels without being tested until the end of the 2-year course. So he was arguing for the retention of the test at the end of year 12. Universities value the AS level as a good indication of future potential, he said. Students value the examination as a good indication of their level, and schools value it as a spur to action for the more lackadaisical. Change your tune a bit now, Tristram. One of the most common objections to testing is that tests are cruel. They create too much pressure. They cause children anxiety and sleepless nights. In extreme cases, testing even makes children cry. This was the thrust of an article that David Baddiel wrote in The Guardian yesterday, attacking the 11 plus.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Quote, my daughter came out of the exam in tears. The atmosphere in the room had been so pressurised and so stiflingly competitive that she'd cracked up and not finished the paper. It made me feel terrible about having put her through the tortuous, soul-crushing process. Well, don't feel too bad about it, David, because being tested at the age of 11 didn't do you any harm. Indeed, it's how you got into Haberdashers Asks, a selective boys' public school in Hertfordshire. Doing a test is also how you got into Cambridge. And after 3 years, you did some more tests and got a double first. Tristram Hunt and Tony Little share similar educational trajectories to David Baddiel, as do, I suspect, many of the people in this audience. Are you really going to sit there and tell me that having to take tests as school children did you irreparable psychological harm? Were your souls really crushed because you had to sit the 11 plus or common entrance? And if you really think the relentless testing that characterises elite selective schools is tantamount to child cruelty, why have you all struggled so hard to get your own children into these soul-destroying exam factories? I'll tell you why. Because deep down, you know that exposing children to relentless testing, encouraging them to compete against each other, and yes, putting them under pressure, is the best preparation for a successful career. How will your child get a good place at a university or a traineeship at a good firm without passing a test? How will he or she gain a foothold on the career ladder, whether as a police officer, a pilot, a nurse, a doctor, an accountant, yes, even a journalist, without taking a series of tests? And how better to prepare them for all that relentless testing than testing them relentlessly as schoolchildren? How better, Tony, to prepare them to navigate the adult world? How better, Tristram, to prepare children for the world of work than relentless testing? And the testing continues long into our careers. We're tested every day. Life is a test. What are Tristram, Tony, Daisy and I engaged in right now, if not a kind of test? Quite a sophisticated test, in fact. We'll be judged not by whose side gets the most number of votes, but by who manages to persuade the greatest number in the hall that they're right. How do we measure that? By doing two tests. One on the way in, a baseline test, and one at the end of the debate. And incidentally, if you accept that that process that you participated in tonight is fair, measuring progress, not just raw results, then I don't see how you can object to the baseline testing of children when they first start primary school that was introduced last year. We can no more measure progress in schools without knowing something about people's starting points than we can in debates. So let's have no more of this ridiculous paternalistic claptrap that children need to be protected from all that horrid testing. It didn't do you any harm, it won't do your children or anyone else's children any harm either. So what really lies behind this hostility to testing? Part of it, I think, is rooted in the progressive critique of traditional education that sees testing and the memorising of facts as inimical to the development of creativity and critical thinking. We heard a bit of that from Tristram. And this apparently is the poisonous legacy of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. That, anyway, is the view of Sir Ken Robinson, whose 18-minute TED talk called Do Schools Kill Creativity? Has been watched over 25 million times. It's actually the most watched TED talk of all time, which Sir Ken has a habit of dropping into conversation, even though he totally disapproves of competitiveness. I believe this passionately, says Sir Ken in this most watched TED talk of all time, that we don't grow into creativity, we grow out of it. Or rather, we get educated out of it. But the notion that schools have to choose between, on the one hand, teaching children subject knowledge and then testing them to see how well they've retained it, and on the other, cultivating their capacity for thinking critically and creatively, problem solving, is a false dichotomy. The two go hand in hand. This was a point made by Bertrand Russell in his 1926 essay On Education. Quote, I do not believe it is possible to train intelligence without imparting information, or at any rate, causing knowledge to be acquired. And this observation has been borne out by cognitive science. The consensus, after three decades of research into the development of the human brain, is that children cannot engage in critical thinking without first having memorized an array of facts relevant to the task at hand. Put simply, you can't think critically or creatively, you can't solve problems if you don't know enough about a subject to think critically about it in the first place. This was the conclusion of the Swedish psychologist Anders Ericsson, author of Toward a General Theory of Excellence, who came up with the 10,000 hours theory that Malcolm Gladwell popularised in Outliers. You need 10,000 hours of practice to achieve mastery in any field. This was the conclusion also of Temple University psychology professor Robert Weisberg, who studied a number of creative geniuses, including Thomas Edison, Frank Lloyd Wright, and Picasso. Quote, you have to immerse yourself in a discipline before you can create in that discipline. To imagine that children are blessed with an innate genius, to paraphrase Einstein, that they can make a creative contribution in a field without first acquiring a wealth of detailed knowledge about that field is romantic hogwash. Just as most eminently practical men are the prisoners of some dead economist, to quote Keynes, so most opponents of testing, and I note the singing bird, are the prisoners of some dead romantic poet. The irony, of course, is that these romantics present their progressive educational ideas as if they're a radical departure from the status quo, when in fact they've been the conventional wisdom in university education departments for at least 50 years. The approach that Robinson and Tristram Hunt and Tony Little promote as revolutionary, child-centred rather than teacher-led, an emphasis on problem-solving instead of learning facts, collaborative co-curricular study instead of competition, a downgrading of subject knowledge in favour of educating the whole being, and above all, liberation from the tyranny of the test, was the norm in British state schools from the mid-70s until a few years ago. I know, because I went to one and I failed all my O-levels. More or less the only thing I'd learnt by the age of 16 was to how to roll a joint. But being middle class, I got a second chance. Children from less affluent backgrounds aren't so lucky. According to a piece of research carried out by Sheffield University in 2009, roughly a fifth of British schoolchildren leave school unable to read or write, and the vast majority of those children are from disadvantaged backgrounds. You may wince at the thought of primary school children having to take a baseline test in reception, a phonics reading check in year one, key stage one SATs in year two, key stage two SATs in year six, but that regime of, yes, relentless testing is the best way to ensure that all children leave primary school able to read and write, including the most disadvantaged. Another objection to testing is that the results are used by central government to hold schools to account, and as a result, getting good test results is prioritised above everything else. But is holding schools to account really such a bad thing? We don't have to conduct a randomised control trial to see how our public education system in England would fare without all this relentless testing. The regional government of Wales has very helpfully done that for us. Lead tables in Wales were abolished in 2001. Children take almost no tests before the age of 16, and not a single academy or free school has been set up. Parental choice in Wales is limited to deciding whether to send a child to a school where lessons are taught in English or Welsh. Hardly surprising, then, that 26%, this is according to the 2011 census, 26% of the Welsh population over 16 have no recognised qualifications whatsoever. It's not just conservative bogeymen like Michael Gove who draw attention to the link between the progressive approach to education and entrenched disadvantage. This was a point made by the Marxist social theorist Antonio Gramsci in his Prison Notebooks. The natural method of teaching advocated by progressives, he wrote, didn't merely perpetuate social differences, but crystallised them in Chinese complexities. We now have enough research evidence to say, with some confidence, that the best way to help children from disadvantaged backgrounds is through conservative teaching methods, not co-curricular learning, but a subject-based, knowledge-rich curriculum, whole-class instruction instead of child-centred learning, traditional teaching methods, what progressives dismiss as drill and kill, but which countless longitudinal studies have established as the most effective way of imparting knowledge, an atmosphere of healthy competition, and above all, frequent testing. A 2011 report by the Sutton Trust disclosed that the gap in academic attainment between rich children and poor children was higher in Britain than in any other developed country in the world apart from America. As Gramsci pointed out, you're not going to dismantle this educational apartheid by confining traditional teaching methods to those children whose parents can afford private education or who are clever enough to get into grammar schools, and condemning the rest to play-based learning and co-curricular group work and sparing them all that nasty anxiety that's associated with competitive testing. Relentless testing doesn't demean education. It's the only way to ensure that children from all backgrounds and of all abilities leave school with a storehouse of essential knowledge and the schools to use it. That, Tristram, is the most effective, tried and tested way of lifting children from disadvantaged backgrounds out of poverty. So there you have the difference between the two sides in this debate. On our side, enlightenment, modernity and social mobility. On their side, paternalism, romanticism and social differences crystallised in Chinese complexities. Thank you.
We're now over to you are going to be voting, and so we are back to Toby. And I won't ask if you were to send your own children off to school at the age of two, what was the matter with the parenting? Why was the parenting sufficient? But I won't ask that, but you're coming in now.
Okay, thank you. So I just wanted to address Tristram's peroration about the benefits of spending more money. You actually quoted in your speech, Tristram, Andreas Schleicher, the head of the Programme for International Student Assessment, PISA, quoted him favourably. He actually said in a piece he wrote for the BBC's website a few months ago that the OECD research, all the research he's done, has found no correlation between the amount that governments spend on education and educational attainment. And a good example of this is Labour's record. After 13 years in office, Labour doubled the amount of money it spent on education in real terms over the course of those 13 years. And unless you take seriously the ever-increasing number of children that got A's and A stars because they kept making the test easier because it made them look good as politicians. And this, once you exclude grade inflation, actually, if you compare the attainment of English school children in that period to their peers around the world, they actually plummeted in the international league tables. It did nothing to close the gap between the most disadvantaged and their peers. Another example, currently, children, 15-year-old school children in Poland and Estonia outperform their 15-year-old equivalents in England, and yet Estonia and Poland spend roughly half as much on teacher salaries as we do. So they're really throwing money at the problem. Increasing expenditure on education is not the solution. Several people have made the point about perverse incentives, and actually they're talking about, for the most part, league table measures rather than tests themselves. So Best 8 isn't introducing another series of tests. It's just a way of assembling the data from the tests that children are doing anyway. And actually, one of the ways in which you can eliminate some of the perverse incentives is by improving these accountability measures. So in the case of Best 8, for instance, you're judging a school according to the average point score across the Best 8 subjects of all the children in the school. And one of the pots that they can dip in to choose their best subjects from is a pot that includes three creative arts subjects. So the initial perverse incentive created by the EBAC category, which discouraged some schools from putting their children in for creative arts subjects, has now been addressed by the creation of Best 8. You can actually address some of the shortcomings of testing these categories.
You should go
in this
to
way.
School, Toby.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed, Toby. Just keeping to the 2 minutes, had Tristram become Secretary of State for Education and asked you to be his advisor, would you have said yes?
As in his special advisor?
His super duper special advisor. The answer is.
I think it's so spectacularly unlikely.
Okay, but he might come in. He might surprise you. Tony Little.
You won't, being the highly intelligent audience you are, have taken anything the other side was trying to claim that somehow we're against testing per se. We're not. It is important, but it's just part of a much richer whole, and there has to be space for to let the imagination soar and to let young people thrive. I heard a great story recently. It was about an EU agriculture meeting which had entered deadlock. And the French delegate was seen to slam his fist onto the table and to shout, "What this meeting needs is la sagesse des Normands, the wisdom of the Normans." And to the delight of the Anglo-Saxons present, this was simultaneously translated as what this meeting needs is Norman wisdom.
And thank you.
I want my school to have testing, but I wanted to have Norman wisdom as well.
And thank you very much. And Daisy.
Thank you. So I do want to just pick up one of the points that someone in the audience made about how much does tests have to be state testing, because I think that was a really good point. And I think some tests do have to be state tests, they have to be state mandated tests. But I also think the state could be smarter in the way it did it. I was asked earlier what kind of test would I introduce. I actually think another one I'd add to that list is the kind of sample standardised tests that they have in Finland, and that I think we're starting to bring in at age 16. And I also think that we don't just have to have state tests, as the point I was making in the second half of my speech was that tests are really valuable for education. So if we could get a bit of a better attitude to them and stop seeing them as being inimical to the aims of education, that would be really valuable. And if I just quickly pick up on some of the points I think I've agreed and disagreed with through tonight, I do agree that some exams are not fit for purpose. I don't want to be in the situation of defending every aspect of the exam system. I've been in the situation as a teacher. I know how demoralising some of these things can be. But I would absolutely say that the one thing I disagree most with the opposition with tonight has been the way they have presented testing as being inimical to the spirit of education. And that is absolutely not the case. I agree completely with Tristram about the importance of teacher quality. Tests help teacher quality. And I know that myself as a teacher. When you look at the data you get from the test feedback, it's hugely helpful. So it's not a binary. It's not a dichotomy. Tests can help teacher quality. Tests can help tackle disadvantage and inequality. And if we keep getting these ideas that somehow tests atomise knowledge and they don't predict anything of value, and that somehow, you know, there's these other things we should be focusing on, actually tests can help us with those things. And we need that change in attitude. So, as I say, we can really get the best kind of tests in the classroom. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Daisy. And coming neatly round to the 8:30 termination point, Tristram.
Well, friends, this is a test. This is a test for you. This is a test for us as to whether we can be brave enough to make the change to our education system, which our country needs, whether we can free our shares from the sort of tired old debates that the other side have put forward. Can we accept that a testing regime suitable for the 1950s, suitable for the era of a Fordist economy and a Fordist society, is out of date? As Tony said, we need to kill off these myths. Testing is important, testing is valuable. But what we're in favour of is a richer understanding of subject knowledge. We're in favour of a much more immersive approach to teaching. We appreciate academic and technical rigour, but the argument is that the testing is getting in the way of it. And I have to say, I'm horrified by Daisy's vision of testing, testing, and more testing. When do these poor children get to learn anything in between the tests? It seems a relentless cycle. And as to her point about the failure of teacher assessment, well, let's focus on the quality of teachers. Let's focus on the quality of the assessment rather than just relentless more testing. Because this is a question of diminishing returns. This is a question of us having hit the performance ceiling in the existing model of education. If we test and test again, we are mandating adequacy. We are not unleashing excellence, and we're not giving young people the skills that they need. Because yes, exams are important, but in working life, in academic life, in professional life, we know that those ways of living and working and loving demand much, much more. So let's not follow the government in introducing yet more standardised testings. They want more English and maths testing in the first year of secondary school. Let's focus on what matters, on early years support, on the quality of teaching, on the strength of leadership, on high-quality technical education. Because I have to tell you that as a Member of Parliament for a disadvantaged area in this country, the current system is not working. Poor children are being let down. The gap between children on free school meals and those on non-free school meals is growing. And as Teach First, the great charity, said, poor children are doing worse under this government. So it is our duty this evening to send out a message that this has to end and that the tyranny of the test is over. Thank you.
And we're still in the process. Thank you very much, all four of you. And thank you also for some really excellent questions from the audience. To remind you of the result of the vote initially, it was 45% for, 25% against, and 30% don't know. And we are going to hear in just a moment what your result is tonight. What is your continuous assessment verdict on the panelists here? And then tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. at Heathrow, everybody in this entire audience, paid for by Intelligence Squared, are off, yes, to a trip to Finland to find out for yourselves what is the truth of this matter. So we're going to see you then, but we're going to have a preliminary vote now, which is going to come up to me, which is in just a moment. I'm going to ask, while I'm waiting for that, Tristram to say, and I think we're all very much hanging on this, we're not quite certain what you would say. Would you have, in honesty, had you Labour won the election, and had you been Education Secretary, would you have appointed Toby as your special advisor? Think about it.
Well,
don't hurry it.
Given that Toby's got through four head teachers already at his free school, I'm not necessarily sure it'd be the best advice I'd want.
That's factually inaccurate.
Thank you.
You've never stopped Tristram before.
That is a point of information which Toby has corrected. So thank you very much for that. And would you like to have been a head teacher yourself?
You're asking me.
Tristram. Yeah, you. You only need 26 years. Tristram, which is.
I'm a historian. I'm a lecturer, and I like being in the lecture hall, and I like teaching young people. And I fear one of the things about being a head teacher, maybe you can tell me differently, is there seems to be a lot of bureaucracy and paperwork and management. And there's no greater enjoyment, I think, than teaching young people and seeing how they learn and how you learn from them. So I'd delighted to teach in a school as a qualified teacher, but probably not a head teacher.
But Tristram, you said how much you enjoy teaching young people, and I know you have taught in schools in your constituency and elsewhere. Why then, as part of Labour's education team going into the election, did you pledge to make it illegal for anyone who wasn't a qualified teacher to be put in front of children and start teaching? Why are you such a poor teacher? You wanted to make it against the law for you to stand in front of children
and
actually impart historical knowledge.
Don't hurry up with the vote. just keep it going. Of your seven myths, Daisy, in your bestseller on education, of your seven myths, which is your most mythical, naughtiest myth? About education.
The idea that you don't have to learn anything anymore because we've all got Google and we've all got smartphones. In actual fact, whatever technology gets invented, you need facts in long-term memory. You can't outsource them to the cloud.
Okay.
More if you want.
And give us your second one.
Second favourite. I think my second favourite is probably projects. The projects are the best way to teach. And in actual fact, projects sound very seductive, they sound very exciting, but in actual fact, they overwhelm working memory, they make it hard for people to learn, and they're often very confusing and don't have all the benefits that the proponents say that they do.
Okay.
I'm not sure about that.
Read the book.
You
haven't yet.
And the Intelligent Person's Guide to Education, Tony, which was serialised in the Times earlier in the year. Did anybody come back and say, well, I'm not very intelligent, so I can't read this? Well, I mean, what would an unintelligent person's guide? And is that the next book?
No, an unintelligent person would probably enjoy it even more.
Sum it up, the wisdom of, just while we are waiting for the vote, what is the distilled wisdom?
It was intended to be a celebration of the relationships and the humanity, the shared humanity that makes education great. It's as simple a proposition as that. And what struck me were the number of letters I had from teachers who felt reassured but said, it ain't what's happening in their school.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And I now have the vote, and don't knows, which speaks obviously because it's a highly intelligent audience, a zero, and against has gone up from 25 to 38, and four has gone up from 45 to 62. Now, I don't need with such an intelligent audience, to tell you that actually the swing was 2% in favour of 4. But can we congratulate both the for and the against on a really fantastic and important debate?
Thank you for listening. You can download more Intelligence Squared podcasts free on iTunes and SoundCloud. If you'd like to find out more about our events, sign up to our newsletter at intelligencesquared.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.